Jerusalem is the holy city of three faiths. It's the prize of empires. Christians believe it to be the site of the judgment day, and it's been a battlefield in one of the current clashes of civilizations. The epic history of Jerusalem is the subject of a new book by Simon Sebag Montefiore called Jerusalem, the Biography, which covers every conquest or occupation. Canaan, Israelite, Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian, Macedonian, Roman, Byzantine, Umayyad, Abbasid, Fatimid, Seljuk, Crusader, Saracen, Ottoman, British, Jordanian, and finally Israeli, to tell the story of this highly contested city. It's published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it brings Simon Sebag Montefiore back to our show today. Hello.
Great to be here.
Three of your previous books were about Russia, one about Prince Potemkin and Catherine the Great, and two about Stalin. So this is a real departure for you, isn't it?
Well, I've been going to Jerusalem since I was a little boy. And I've always wanted to find a way to write this book. In fact, I wanted to find this book to read it myself. And as Benjamin Disraeli said, when I want to read a book, I write it. And so humbly, I've written it.
Well, there's a neighborhood called Montefiore, just outside of the old city walls. Is that connected to the family?
That's right. I mean, that's why I've always been going there since I was a child. My ancestor Moses Montefiore built the first suburb outside the old city walls. So he was really the founder of the new city of Jerusalem. And that's one small reason why I've always grown up with Jerusalem in my family.
Well, your title, Jerusalem, a Biography, makes it seem as though you're looking at the city as a person. Did you approach it as though you were writing about a historic figure?
There are so many books about bits of Jerusalem. There are virtually no books about all of Jerusalem, all sets, right up from King David to today, which is what this is.
Well, you do end with the Six-Day War.
Well, I go right up till, Netanyahu, the Arab Spring, but everything is in proportion so that, the last 40 years is not, I don't spend hundreds of pages talking about Israeli settlements. Everything has to be in proportion. So it goes right up till today, right up to Obama.
One reviewer found it remarkable that you could write a book about such a divisive city and yet remain neutral in your account of its history. Did you come to this book with any preconceptions?
Many preconceptions, and I'm a Montefiore, I'm also a Jew, I come from a family with Zionist connections, but there was no point in writing a Zionist history, a pro-Palestinian history. I think that this
They've
book,
already been written,
They've been
they?
Written many times, and in fact, this book is really without bias, and, It tells the Arab story, it tells the Armenian story, it tells the Jewish story and the Zionist story. And I think this is as close as you can get to, if that's possible, to a history without bias.
Well, you were lucky that you had such an incredible cast of characters.
Yeah.
I mean it's some of the most famous people that ever lived.
Everybody from sort of Caligula to Churchill. And, I also wanted to show the history of Jerusalem, not just a dark city of massacres and slaughter and bigotry, but also sex and women and love affairs and poetry and food and dancing and all of it. And that's all here, I hope.
Although you do start off with a lot of blood. You've organized this book chronologically, but you begin with the sack of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD by Titus and then retrace the history back to King David. Why did you break the chronological thread in this one case?
I always start my books with a dashing, dramatic, exciting event that introduces the reader, hooks the reader, hopefully, and introduces the reader to all the major themes of the book, which is, in this book, some of the key themes are holiness, identity, empire. But you could also read it as just a saga, the greatest story ever told of empresses and prophets and whores and poets.
But let's go back to when it was the capital of David's small kingdom. It's a lot smaller than I ever imagined. 15 acres?
Yeah. I mean, the truth is,
That's smaller than a village.
It was like a stronghold. It was a small stronghold. The two most controversial parts of the book are the beginning and the end, obviously. And the King David period is deeply controversial. In Jerusalem, people die for the myths. People die for the stories of Jerusalem. And yet, as a historian, I'm interested in facts. But I'm also interested in the myths, too, because without the myths, there would be no Jerusalem.
Well, since it was such a small place, yeah. Would it have been possible for him not to spot Bathsheba?
Yeah, that's right. My daughter's called Bathsheba, incidentally, and the book is dedicated to her for that reason.
And his child with Bathsheba was Solomon. Did Solomon change things? Did he expand the size of the city?
Yeah, I mean, the building of the temple, the Jewish temple, really created the template for holiness for all the three great faiths right up to Islam, you know, and so that was a decisive moment. And in fact, you're touching on an interesting thing there, Leonard, because, you know, Jerusalem evolved, you know, became the center of the world by evolution, but it also is the result of the decisions of about 10 men, and David and Solomon are two of them.
Was Solomon the wise ruler that legend would have us believe?
We know virtually nothing about him. There's actually no archaeological proof that he existed at all. But we know that within about 30 years of his death, there was a Jewish temple in a Jewish city in a Jewish kingdom there.
What was it like by the time Titus set about to destroy it?
Well, that was King Herod the Great city, and the Herods are one of my favorite bits of the book. You know, Herod the Great really was the Jewish Stalin, the biblical Henry VIII.
And he was, who gave him the name the Great?
It was because of his building, and also because he was actually one of five kings. There were five King Herods, all of whom were appallingly brutal and yet talented characters, and he built the Second Temple.
And he was rather adept as a diplomat. He was kind of better in dealing with Rome than Cleopatra, his contemporary.
That's right. He actually beat Cleopatra. Cleopatra wanted to destroy him, and really it was kind of dog eat dog. And Herod survived to expand his kingdom and become one of the richest men in the Roman Empire, best friends with Augustus, and of course, builder of the great, most majestic Jerusalem.
And most important, you tell us, he also dyed his hair.
He dyed his hair. He was very touchy about his sexual prowess. When two of his sons mocked his hair dyeing and his sexual prowess, he had them garrotted in public.
His own sons.
He killed three of his own sons, and he killed his own adored wife.
So, considering the fact that he was a friend of Rome, why do we wind up with Titus destroying the city?
Oh, well, that's jumping ahead about 60 years. But there was still a King Herod at that time.
His grandson?
His great-grandson. And he was in Titus's entourage. He was a pro-Roman. The Jews rebelled. And in the end, they were besieged in the temple, and Titus destroyed it afterwards.
And you say the Romans killed 500 Jews a day until they ran out of wood because they were crucifying them. Was crucifixion their preferred method of execution?
Yeah, it was the preferred method of execution, and that's why it's part of the reason why we know that with Jesus Christ, it was almost certainly the Romans and not the Jews who were responsible for the nature of his death.
And what were they killing these people for? What had they been accused of?
Well, they were in rebellion, but all the hillsides around Jerusalem must have resembled a sort of diabolical forest of macabre visions. It was terrible. It was like the Siege of Leningrad or something in the 20th century.
And things weren't all that great for the survivors, were they?
No, they were kept in concentration camps, which was sort of courts. The courts of the temple were used as concentration camps, and they were all either killed or sold into slavery, as many as 500,000 of them.
Some of them were forced to die in the circus.
That's right, to kill each other, and it was a terrible thing. And it was the second time Jerusalem was destroyed completely down to the rock. And yet, ironically, one of the fascinating things about Jerusalem is that these two destructions of Jerusalem intensified its holiness all the more, and that which is kind of ironic.
Was this the beginning of the diaspora?
Yeah, it was really the beginning of the diaspora. There already were Jews all over, you know, in Babylon and all around the Roman Empire, but it was the beginning of what we call Judaism today, and it was also the beginning of Christianity, because Christianity separated from the mother faith in 70 as well. That's why I chose to begin the book, because it was such a key moment.
But not everybody left. 60 years after Titus, the Emperor Hadrian had to face another better-led Jewish revolt, didn't he?
That's right, Simon Bar Kokhba. And after that, he really destroyed the Jews. He changed the name of Judea to Palestina after the Jewish enemies, the Philistines.
But the Philistines had pretty much disappeared from the face
right.
of the earth, so he was just kind of rubbing it in.
Yeah, he was just rubbing the Jews' nose in it. He changed the name of the name of Jerusalem to rename it after himself, and it wasn't called Jerusalem for hundreds of years.
So how did a little later Emperor Constantine's edict that all regions of the Roman Empire must convert to Christianity affect life in Jerusalem?
Well, he started to convert Jerusalem into a kind of almost like a Christian center, a Christian shrine with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And then Jerusalem became really important to the Christians for the first time. It hadn't really been very important in the early years of Christianity. And now it became, from then on, many Christians regarded it as the center of the world.
And why not Bethlehem?
Well, that's right. He chose Jerusalem. I mean, he could have made that decision. That's what I mean. You're putting your finger right on it. That's just it. Constantine's decision about Jerusalem was decisive.
And then we see the same thing with Muhammad, because he also considers Jerusalem a central city. It could have been Mecca. Mecca is a major city in the history of Islam.
Yeah, and the Muslims first of all prayed towards Jerusalem. And Muhammad knew the Jewish scriptures extremely well and the Christian ones. And he believed that a judgment day was imminent. And he knew from those scriptures that judgment day couldn't happen anywhere but in Jerusalem. And that was one of the reasons the Muslims were so keen to take Jerusalem, which they did in 638 AD.
So Judgment Day was something that was being discussed that early?
Absolutely. In the Quran is full of references to the hour is nigh and the hour is near and so on. It's going to happen any minute. Just as Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is nigh. You know, repent. The kingdom of heaven is upon us.
You write that for Christians and Muslims, the sanctity of the city grew out of the exceptionalism of the Jews as the chosen people. Jerusalem became the chosen city, Palestine the chosen land, and this exceptionalism was inherited and embraced by the Christians and the Muslims.
That's right. The fascinating thing about holiness is that it's infectious. And one of the reasons people find these shrines holy in Jerusalem is because the other two religions already do.
My guest is Simon Sebag Montefiore. His latest book, Jerusalem, the Biography, it's published by Knopf. You write, Jerusalem is the holy city, yet it has always been a den of superstition, charlatanism, and bigotry, the cosmopolitan home of many sects, each of which believes the city belongs to them alone. So is there a way that all of the different groups can ever learn to worship there and coexist?
Well, the tragedy is that now we're reduced to two, really. You know, the one and the other, the Israelis and the Palestinians.
But there are lots of Christians there, and they wind up getting involved in the fight.
Less and less. Well, the Christians are still fighting. The Christian sects, the Orthodox, the Latins and the Armenians are still fighting viciously.
Amongst
in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And in fact, Israeli policeman told me that he said, forget the Palestinian protesters. The most vicious people we have to deal with in the fights in Jerusalem are these Armenian and Orthodox monks.
And they are people who came to Jerusalem at some point before or after the Crusades?
Yes, but many of the Orthodox are actually Palestinians. I mean, that's the wonder of Jerusalem. The Jerusalem I write about has many, many identities. And that's one of the joys of writing about it. I mean, the Armenians, the Georgians, the Maronites, and so on. There's so many different sorts, and that makes it exciting.
What are some of the superstitions that you referred to?
Oh, well, the superstitions, there are so many superstitions many of them are simply things that they're historically wrong. For example, the most famous one is the Via Dolorosa. Almost certainly, the Via Dolorosa, celebrated by millions of Christian pilgrims every year, is not the site that historically Jesus walked down with his cross. This is due to a mistake.
Does Mel Gibson know this?
Mel Gibson may not know this, but you may well ask, does it matter if these people find it holy? Then that's fine by me. Well, you can't write a book about Jerusalem without respecting religion, which I do.
Well, you write that 100 patients a year are committed to the city's asylum, suffering from the Jerusalem syndrome. A madness of anticipation, disappointment, and delusion. Is the Jerusalem syndrome a medical diagnosis?
Yeah, it's a real medical diagnosis. And in fact, there's a hugely learned paper about it with a guide for tour guides at the end about what things to look out for in case a member of their group is coming down with the Jerusalem syndrome. And the third thing is beware of a member of your group fashioning a toga-like robe out of hotel bed linen. This is a key thing to look out for. But in fact, it's serious. I mean, virtually all the, not only Christian pilgrims, but Jews, Muslims, and virtually all the secular rulers of Jerusalem, too, seem to suffer from a sort of madness the moment they get possession of Jerusalem.
Well, there seemed to be a madness even earlier when, as we were describing earlier, Roman soldiers were crucifying 500 Jews a day in the run-up to the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70. Jews and Gentiles alike wore nails from the victims as charms.
That's right. And of course, there was a huge cult of relics. In the Middle Ages, there was a huge sale, a market in embalmed babies who were supposed to have been killed in the Massacre of the Innocents. And by the way, Herod the Great committed many, many crimes, but that was the only one he almost certainly didn't commit.
Well, there were other. There was a Jewish king of the first century BC, Alexander Janneus, who slaughtered 50,000 of
his
own people.
That's right.
Why
he was
a
Maccabee. He was a Maccabee, and the Maccabees are also. I mean, one of the things this book is a saga of great families, and the Maccabees, of course, were one of those great families who came to power as great Jewish freedom fighters, beating a superpower, the Seleucid Empire, which they did. And then once they had power, they became kind of Greek-style tyrants and were very brutal.
And also engaged in crucifixion.
And used crucifixion, like all the kings of the East.
So I mentioned earlier there's this incredible cast of players in your story. We have Nebuchadnezzar, we have Jesus, Muhammad, Alexander the Great, Cleopatra, Caligula, Nero, and then later the German Kaiser, Disraeli, Rasputin.
Yeah.
How does Rasputin get into the story?
Well, you know, Russia was terribly important. You know, the Russians poured in tens of thousands as pilgrims. Many of the Russian women, I discovered, became stranded. They were peasant women. They became stranded in Jerusalem and became the mistresses or prostitutes of powerful Palestinian magnates. And this is all in a wonderful Palestinian diary of a lute player, a musician, who organized orgies for these people. And so this is just one way we see a new Jerusalem that the foreigners never saw, and wonderful material. But Rasputin was one of the people who visited.
Now, the Crusades changed Jerusalem, and Saladin, it becomes a key historic figure. Later, Suleiman the Magnificent. How long was the legacy of the... Did the legacy of the Crusades last, or can we say it's still there?
Well, it's still very much there, because the Queen Melisende, the greatest Crusader queen, the Margaret Thatcher of the Crusades, if you like, she built the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that exists today, and all the markets. So that was very important. But Suleiman the Magnificent was also a hugely vital character. He built... I mean, before Suleiman the Magnificent, there had been no walls around Jerusalem for 300 years. So the Mongol hordes just galloped through, and he built the walls. So he was very important.
And what happened in all those years until the 20th century?
Well, you know, the Ottomans were vibrant at first and powerful, and then they began to lose control. Jerusalem became a forgotten village, half empty, constantly sacked by warlords.
Pilgrims went there,
but not that many. And it really became important again when Napoleon invaded Egypt, a little dirty Middle Eastern war. Sounds familiar. He didn't quite make it to Jerusalem, but he was a Zionist, and he promised the Jews that they could have Jerusalem when he took it, which he never did. But that started the Western interest again in Jerusalem, which grew and grew and grew in the 19th century until the great powers, England, France, and it filled with Americans. And there's a huge American story in this book, especially since Christopher Columbus was obsessed with Jerusalem.
And then later Mark Twain wrote about it.
Well, Mark Twain wrote a brilliant... Him and Columbus would not have agreed on their visions of Jerusalem, because Columbus was desperate to conquer Jerusalem and rebuild a Christian temple there. And Mark Twain was, as you know, a great cynic who wrote so wittily about it.
Part of the tension between current Jews and Palestinians involves... How many people were there before the 1945 or so, whether there was a Jewish majority, whether there was a Palestinian majority, who were running the businesses? What is the real story?
The real story is surprising, and that is that, you know, before Herzl even invented Zionism, the Jews were the largest group in Jerusalem. And so it's simply not true that there was no Jewish presence before Zionism. Part of the sort of anti-Israeli, there's terrible anti-Israeli propaganda, there's terrible anti-Palestinian propaganda, both of which is rubbish, and both of which this book rebuts strongly. But since you ask on this way around...
Well, answer it the other way around as well.
And the other way around as well. The truth is that the Jews were... There was a huge Jewish population, and there had always been a Jewish presence in Jerusalem all the way back to Hadrian except when banned on pain of death. So that's one thing. And virtually every Jew since 70 AD had been a Zionist in some form.
So the Ottoman Empire just tolerated the Jews?
They tolerated the Jews, and in fact they were very, you know, the local Arab population was very close to the Sephardic Jews, the Middle Eastern Jews. The problem started when Jews started to pour in from Russia and Poland, and they didn't learn Arabic. They spoke Yiddish, totally different culture. And that started to change the nature of the city. And that was in the late 19th century when the pogrom started.
There was also tension with the Sephardic Jews when the Ashkenazic Jews came in.
That's right. There was a lot of problems between the two, and there is today, just as there is today between the Haredi, the religious ultra-Orthodox, and the secular Jews. In fact, every single sect in Jerusalem is divided unto itself.
So it sounds to me like we have an impossible situation. A lot of different people pulling in many different directions, and doesn't seem to be all that much room for compromise.
Well, you know, Jerusalem is the trouble with it is that Jerusalem, so much intensity is now heaped on the delicate stones of Jerusalem. You know, it's not only the fact that increasing numbers of Christians, including American evangelicals, but Jews and Muslims are now fundamentalist believers and believe very much that the Second Coming, the Mahdi, the Messiah, will come to Jerusalem outside the Golden Gate. And, of course, if you believe that, it's impossible to compromise with anybody else. But on top of that, you know, Jerusalem is so much geopolitically the center of the world again now. You know, the center of Iran versus America, of Israel versus Palestine, of all the crosshairs of all the great crises and conflicts. It's never been more important and never harder to settle.
And there are any number of places that people all claim, like on the Temple Mount.
And
even calling it the Temple Mount becomes a problem.
Oh, yeah, that's a big problem. I mean, you've got to, you know, it's a Haram al-Sharif for Muslims, it's a Temple Mount for Jews. And the Muslims, one of the things the Muslims claim, which is not true, is that, you know, there was no Jewish temple there. Of course there was. But it's never been more the holy city and the universal city.
Simon Sebag Montefiore's books have been published in over 35 languages. There was Potemkin, Catherine the Great's Imperial Partner, Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar, which was awarded the History Book of the Year Prize for the British Book Awards. Young Stalin won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Biography and other awards. And now we have Jerusalem, the Biography, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Lovely to be here. Thanks a lot.